session number 23198, Real Tim.
Mr. Watson, Real 10, we were looking at a sort of typical mission in Lancaster's, and you were talking about how you used to look out and search the sky. You said it depended on where the Lancasters were, if you could continue.
Yeah. If you were, depended on a day light operation or a night light. If we're talking about a night light one, then you had really to concentrate on where the fighter is likely to come from. And invariably, the German technique was to attack from underneath. And they had, in some of their aircraft, a gun projecting above, from behind the pilot, at an angle of 45 degrees or more, so that they could approach the target from well underneath and fire upwards without having to point the aircraft upwards, because the gun was set. So he can therefore, if he had the guns pointing forward, he would have to come up into the arc of fire of the rear gunner. If he would come in like that and he had his fixed gun, that was a cannon actually, he could fire. He could come from way down below, see you against the stars or moon or whatever was light above, and just gradually increase his height unobserved underneath you and then blast you with his upward pointing cannon.
So you were looking out for them especially?
Yes, because it was a mode of attack. They didn't attack from above because they were likely to be seen. First of all, because you had a mid-upper gunner there, and you also had the rear gunner looking up. So they came up from underneath.
And did you you just looked with your naked eye? You didn't have binoculars or anything?
Oh, no, hopeless. No.
Did your eyes get tired looking, so, you know?
Yes, it did. It did. But then you recovered, you see, went to sleep afterwards and recovered. Being young, you recovered very quickly.
So you were flying out and looking more and more intently where you thought they might come from. Mm. And what would happen next on a typical raid?
Well, they varied. You see, the Germans had strategically placed their fighter fields and the anti-aircraft concentrations where they thought they would be targeted. So if you were going, a favourite target, of course, was the Ruhr. The Ruhr was a... And the Ruhr consisted, of course, you know, the Düsseldorf and Frankfurt and all these industrial cities producing armaments for the German forces, and the Ruhr was a frequent target. And of course Göring in his planning had arranged for his fighter squadrons to be strategically placed to intercept. Remember, he said that no enemy aircraft would fly over the Reich when he was expanding the Luftwaffe. So the nearer you got to the Ruhr towns, the heavier became the anti-aircraft barrages. And on the way there, of course, they had the outer ring of fighter stations, night fighter stations and day fighter stations. They knew what we were trying to do, and before the war they had this all planned out. So
the fighters, and there were the anti-aircraft fire.
Oh, yes.
What was the anti-aircraft fire like?
Oh, bloody heavy, because the Germans, they were expert at armaments. I think much better than we were.
What was it like?
Well, the aircraft was rocking around because the bursts created turbulence. The other thing was that you were in a stream of Lancasters and bombers, more or less in close vicinity. Their slip streams were, you were hitting them, and of course it caused the aircraft to veer about, difficult to control. And if you got a flak burst close to you under the wing, of course the aircraft was blowing up like this. So it was a very rough ride. And you could also, certainly in daylight, you could see, I almost looked back into the fuselage and you could see the sunbeams going through the holes.
the searchlight beams?
No, yes, at night the searchlight beams, but you, if you were coned. But in the daylight the raids, when the bright sunshine, I remember looking back, and all I could, we were hit, the explained the H2S blister, I better tell you this, and it took the blister and the radar scanner out, and the radar scanner was about the size of this, and this big blister underneath, Perspex thing, which gave you a picture, you see.
We'll talk about it.
Yeah, sir. Blew the whole thing out. I turned, and the back of the turret doors, when you turned around, there was panels, Perspex. Look round, and there was a hole twice the size of this table there, dust everywhere. Where the dust came from, God knows. And it's just and the sun shining through, and all these holes, and you could see the sunbeams coming on, and all this dust. And to get, when I came to come out of the aircraft, I had to walk along the side, hanging on to the sort of ribs of the, because there was a big hole there. Anyway, that's the same.
Did it rock, when it hit like that, did it bash the plane about?
Hell yes.
So, I mean, you get anti-aircraft fire, and then what would happen next as you approach your target? We'll talk about the photograph, the HGS, later.
Well, pilot tried to stay straight and level to give the bomb aimer a chance, you see. And the bomb aimer got down, and he would be, of course, he'd studied the target map, and he was responsible really for directing the pilot, because he had studied the target map. It was maybe he'd been down in the bomb in his position all the way across, looking down, because he would say, crossing a river now, Ian, to the navigator, there was an oxbow bend, so and so, and Ian would be looking at his chart. Yes, oh, that's a good fix, because he would know where he was then, you see. And so the bomb aimer, as he came up to the target, he would be lying down there, and he would, if there was any landmarks, such as crossing a canal or so, he would report it. When we came near the target, Ian would tell him, the navigator, and he would be going sort of right, steady, and then he would say, I think I've got the target. And he'd go left, left, steady, right, 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 10 degrees, steady, steady on that, and then he would say, coming up to the target, the next thing you would hear would be, bomb's gone. So that's a description of what you would get.
And would the aircraft lift as the bombs left?
Yeah. Just as if a pregnant woman, after giving birth, I should think, a huge sigh of relief.
Now, what about this photograph? When would you take that? You know, you took with this, was it HGS or H2S?
H2S.
H2S,
home,
sorry.
Home Sweet Homes, according, so you'll remember that.
Now, when would you take that photograph?
It was taken at the...
Well, could you explain all about it? Because we missed that bit on the telephone.
Well, the photograph could be taken... It didn't need someone... The camera was mounted in the body of the aircraft overlooking the bomb bay. Could only take with the bomb doors open. So, and it was, as far as I remember, it was released from the bomb aimer's position on his panel. He flicked the switch and the literally triggered the flash.
The idea was, where was the flash? That was
no, it dropped. He released it, and it was timed according to the level it was flying. It was timed to flash as it dropped. It was a bomb type thing, right? Now it sometimes stuck. It didn't work. So what happened next was the bomb aimer had a piece of wire and a hook, and he went there and did, I don't know what he did, but he released the damn thing, because if he didn't release the photographs, very dangerous, because if it went off in that bloody thing,
in the bomb bay,
in the bomb bay, you were doomed.
So this would flash, and then the photograph would be taken
automatically
from the Perspex dome.
Yeah.
And that was to record where your bombs had gone, presumably.
That's right. That's right.
So having made the run, what would you do then? You know, having dropped the bombs, taken the H2S photo.
You didn't turn immediately. That would be fatal, because you're turning into a dozen other bloody Lancasters coming after you. You carried on, and according to what the briefing said, and then you started a turn, being very careful at the time. We usually descended, and some climbed to be safe, but all you got to the briefing was you turn on to so-and-so. Now, there were various theories about how you should come back, whether you should come back on the recommended course or divert, because once the German night fighters were airborne, their ground controllers had by this time established the track going back. So, of course, they were vectored onto it. They were given a heading, and they had taped some of the German conversation. Of course, we didn't understand them, but they just gave us an idea of the gabbling that went on between the Germans, the ground forces, the searchlight crews, and the who are tied up to the anti-aircraft batteries. And this gave us a taste of, really, I mean, we didn't understand what they were saying, but you got the drift of it. And so therefore, we decided that it wasn't a good thing to stick to the recommended track, that probably the majority would. This track took us clear of the anti-aircraft, known anti-aircraft batteries as possible. But of course, it had another consequence, was that these aircraft and searchlight batteries reported your track, and they had plotted you out nicely. And on that track, they were warning the boys ahead, you know, this lot are coming your way, get airborne. So we used to bugger off a bit different.
Were you allowed to do that then?
No, you weren't supposed to. But you see, when Ian handed in his log, he was careful that handed in his log to the navigation leader on return. You see? So he made sure that our track didn't show where we actually were.
And what would happen on the return home? You'd be on your own then, mostly.
Yes, well, there was a bomber streak. But you could tell when you were on your way home, because you would see them flamers on the ground. So those had been shot down. And, of course, the German night fighter pilots, 1-1-1, well, we'll go up here. They're bound to be going that way. So it was wise to not to stay with the mob, as it were. At least we thought so.
Were you ever attacked by night fighters, or would it be best to look at some of the individual occurrences when you do that? I mean, were you attacked per your aircraft? Did you have to open fire much?
Yes, twice. One was on a Ju-88, and another time, both Ju-88s actually. The trouble was that the Ju-88 looked very like a British bullfighter. Twin engine, two radial engines, and a short nose. And they were airborne at night as well, you see.
They're the pathfinders, or
well, they were intruders and night fighters. You see, they went hunting at night as well. And it was very... I think I actually opened fire on a bullfighter. But it was better to do that and frighten them off, even though they were British, than take the risk that they wasn't a Bowman bullfighter and shoot you down.
So you didn't hit either time you got, or not as far as you were away?
Well, I reckon I hit, if this, I reckon it was a bullfighter afterwards, but you couldn't take a risk, you see. And it's damn difficult if you'd see a twin engine aircraft with big engines.
But you didn't shoot it down?
No, I didn't shoot it down, but
and that was the
it
only
must have
two
hit.
That was the only two times?
Twice that I opened fire.
So you were, in a sense, you were lucky not to be attacked by a real German night fighter.
Yeah.
So as you were approaching home?
We got more through ground fire on the low level ones. I mean, we were riddled. We lost two aircraft because of that.
I'll come to some of them. You know,
and daylight.
What about you mentioned the toilet latrine? So you know, because you were up to 6 hours sort of thing.
Yeah.
What would you do about that? You said you tried not to go. I mean, were there any toilet facilities on the plane, or what was done
just
about?
Just the Elsan, but
the what?
Elsan.
Elsan. What's that?
That's a chemical toilet. It's still on the go, I think, and caravans and things. Elsa.
What was that like? You tried not to use it.
It was just like a dustbin with a plastic lid, and it also had a plastic seat, and it had a lid which was clamped down by an elastic band, you see, so that, and in it was Jay's fluid, you know, the disinfectant stuff. I don't know how much, just a bit. And because it slopped around, the lid was tight-fitting, and an elastic band over it held it on, so that when the aircraft was going about, it didn't slop the stuff out. I never, ever used it. I always made sure that I didn't drink much before I went, and that I always relieved myself from the tail wheel. And it became such a fetish that though I didn't need a pee, I was forced to go. It's amazing what the good luck things were. And
do you remember any others?
I know I could tell you some stories about that. I'll just tell you one. Ground staff, all the WAF drivers and all the people were always told that they must report anything they saw about an airplane that was suspicious. If they saw a screwdriver left on the top of a tyre, take it away because it might puncture a tyre, fall off that tyre and another aircraft roll over it and puncture it. Some mechanic had left a tool there. If they saw any liquid oil or anything dripping from it, report it. And so we arrived at the aircraft, and I was at the rear behind the wing, and the transport was driven by the WAF girl, and Jimmy was up in the pilot's part, and he was chatting at her out the window of the right-hand side, and she was there. And I was at the tail behind there, and I was doing my works on the tail wheel. And this girl happened to look back. Cool. Jimmy, there's water coming out the back of your aeroplane. You see? And he says, go away with you, you see, in his usual guff. Go away, and yes, there is. And so Jimmy was very sceptical. He says, is it oil? No, it isn't oil. I'll go back and take a look. She came back with her vehicle and looking over, and I was just tied up my trousers. Oh dear, a bit embarrassing really.
So that was the example. We'll crouch come to some of the other superstitions. Now, what about the cold when you were up there? I mean, you got all these jobs. How bad was it for you?
Bloody cold. That's all I can say. I wore goggles, much against my will, because I didn't think it did any good for your vision. They weren't corrected. But your eyelids, you know, they sort of stuck. They didn't stop you, freeze your eyes and that, but they made them sort of hard to blink, you know. As far as cold and hands are concerned, I remember coming back and I wondered what my hands coming off was sticky, and I'd been banging my hands in the control column to keep, and I didn't know it, but I'd got my hands.
You're banging them to sort of get them working again. So they were freezing up. Was it mainly your hands and your eyes, because the rest of you was in this body?
And your face got very cold. But the mask covered your face, but as I told you, we put wasn't.
So, but your body was warm from the electric suit?
From the electric suit.
That did keep you warm?
Yes.
So, hands, face?
Yes, yes. And one
feet?
Yes. On one occasion, it failed. Electrical fail. So it was bloody cold, but that was only one occasion it failed. I think it was a fuse gone somewhere.
Now, you wouldn't take anything with you to eat or drink then?
Yes, we got nothing to drink. We got wakey-wakey tablets.
What were they? Amphetamines or...?
Yes, things to keep you awake if you felt drowsy.
And did they work? Did you take them?
I didn't need to take them, actually, but I had them there. I mean, you took them with you. So that if you did, if the crew thought you were getting a bit sleepy, you took one. But you also had, you got packets of white sweets, what were they called? They were energy and special sweets made for providing energy and...
So glucose stuff. Sweets, that sort of
That's
thing.
The word, glucose. You got a packet of these.
So did you ever try the wakey-wakey tablets, or you never...
No, I...
But you used the glucose.
I used the glucose, oh yes.
So did they work?
Oh yes, so you suck them and kept your mouth inclined to get dry. And I suppose that was a sign of apprehension, I don't know. But I used to get them. And chewing gum. We used to get chewing gum. Got to keep your mouth sort of moist. In fact, there's a bit, I think I showed you, didn't I? A bit on the whistle.
Yes, on your whistle, yeah. Now, what would happen as you got over England and came back? What was the land, you know, as you approached the landing, what was the thing there?
Well, of course, the big problem, as you know, the country was blacked out, and the aerodromes were blacked out unless they were actually flying. Up here it didn't matter so much. I mean, they were well away from... But the Germans had a habit of sending intruders into the circuit, our circuits, and of course if the lights were on, it was a doodle, because they just waited until a lamp came into the circuit and then shut them down. So we were very wary of coming in, and of course the airdrums themselves were very wary. And it was not unusual to be coming downwind to turn on to the final approach when all the bloody lights would go out, which was a consequence of landing on top of another lamp.
That's one incident that happened. Yeah. Tell me about a normal landing first. So how would you land?
Well, the system of lighting on an airfield, there was the omnidirectional lights and the unidirectional lights that shone into the approach. That was on the runway. And uni meant the shining in that direction of approach. And you then had the what they called the funnels, or latterly became the finals, but it was the funnels, which led into the final approach center line. And on the threshold of the runway, I'll assume that's a runway, there was a touchdown bar, and on here there were two what they call sodiums. Now the sodiums was only put on the sodium players, I think they still use them, when the fog was very intense. Now leading up to that, there was the approach lights to the touchdown bar. The touchdown bar was green, and your omnidirectional lights were along here, and your unidirectional lights were along here. Now, depending on the alert state, the runway lights were either off, on, or depending on the weather, uni or omni. They preferred to use as little as possible because A, they were switched off until you were actually approaching the land or take off, of course, because the Germans had a habit of focusing on them and bombing them. So you have the lights here and you have the approach lights, funnel approach leading into it. On when we moved to Fiskerton, I don't know if I told you, we moved from Elsham Walls to Fiskerton, and it had Fido.
That was in November 1944.
Yeah. Fido was fog intensive not departure of, the last word was of, dispersal of. Fog intensive dispersal of, Fido. And that consisted of pipes down the runway, either side, and these pipes were pierced with tiny holes, and petrol was pumped through these pipes. It could be half the runway or it could be a full runway, but generally they only used the first third of the runway to save fuel because it was so expensive to run it. And this was to burn the fog off so that you could get onto the runway and then you could do the rest of the bit of the landing on the usual omnidirectional lights. So they only lit one part, the first 200 or 300 yards, with Fido because of the expense. But only certain aerodromes had this facility.
And what was Fiskerton? Now what would happen normally when you landed then?
Well, you rolled then, he kept rolling to the end of the runway because there was another bloke behind you. And quite often it was maybe in one or two engines and you want. If there was a situation like that and there was somebody in the circuit with a wounded person, then you held off until he got down first. If there was somebody in two engines or three engines you didn't worry so much, but two engines it was getting a bit dodgy. But the lamp could fly on two, and he would get a priority. You would hold off above him, you see. But normally, if all was well, quite often to come back with a dicky engine, But it didn't cause any path. You could land on three.
And what was the landing like?
Usually quite smooth. The aircraft was light, you see. It's the takeoff you're worried about. And Jim said, get off, you bitch, and stick, and stick. He's trying to get the damn thing off the ground.
And on landing, it was just smooth.
Oh, there was no problem.
You weren't bashed about?
No. You bumped, you know, bounced, but I mean, that was nothing.